To start off the show today, the big story is the WikiLeaks story. The story of some 90,000 documents, which have been published in part by the New York Times, the British newspaper The Guardian, and the German magazine Der Spiegel, after they were released on the internet by an organization called WikiLeaks, which look into some of the actual documentation behind our war in Afghanistan. To offer some perspective on this and to talk about his own experiences in Afghanistan and Pakistan is former CBS News correspondent Jerry Van Dyke, who's written a book about his time as a hostage. It's called Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. Jerry, it's nice to talk to you again.
Good afternoon, Paul. Nice to hear your voice again.
But before we get to your horrid experience there of 45 days as a hostage, tell us a little bit about your perspective on this WikiLeaks report that's out today, which says, among other things, that the Pakistani intelligence forces are behind some of the insurgency in Afghanistan, thus, which means to me that we're funding the people who we're fighting against.
I have, unfortunately, direct... Yes, I can directly respond to that from my own experiences. One of my jailers, my main jailer, said to me when I was a prisoner up in a place called, near as I can tell, what they said was Damodola, the Bajur Agency in the mountains, in deep in the tribal areas of Pakistan, 2008. He said not a shot would be fired in Afghanistan without the approval of the Pakistani military. I was often told that various members of the ISI, Pakistani military intelligence, would come and go into the very compound where I was being held. Did they know I was there? I don't think they ever did. But they always talked about the degree to which the Pakistani army and the Taliban worked together. I asked them once. I've read these reports in all the major newspapers, and I listen to what intelligence read the newspapers, magazines, and on television and radio, you hear about the 90,000 Pakistani soldiers that are along the border working supposedly in tandem with the United States to stamp out the Taliban. And he said, you will never see any Pakistani soldiers along the border. We patrol the border for the Pakistani army. And I said, how can you prove that? And he said, you haven't seen any soldiers. And I said, no. Plus, you're here, aren't you? You're in this prison, aren't you? We do the work for the Pakistani army. How do you prove this? I don't know, but anecdotal evidence and all the times I was with the Taliban as a hostage and the times beforehand when I was trying to find out who was behind the Taliban and to what degree were they different from the Mujahideen whom I had lived with in the 1980s as a newspaper reporter, and they said to a man, we are in effect the sons of the Mujahideen. One man even detailed the amount of money they got for setting off an IED, for when the IED went off, for stealing an American uniform, for killing an American soldier, and the amount of money that a suicide bomber didn't get himself, but went to his family. So in effect, what you said at the outset, in my belief, is true, that that Pakistan is very, very possibly using U.S. aid money to kill American soldiers.
Pakistan receives more than $1 billion a year from this country. So every taxpayer listening to this, you are, in essence, funding the forces that are funding the forces that are fighting against our men and women in Afghanistan. How, if you know this, Jerry, and people inside the Pentagon must have known it now that we're getting these documents leaked out, how is that allowed to continue?
I don't know, and I firmly believe it. And what I find incredulous is that now this war has gone on for 9 years. Surely the U.S. administration, whether the Bush administration and to a much greater degree the Obama administration, knows this. But General David Petraeus, just 2-3 weeks ago, I saw the photograph in the newspapers, met with General Kiani, head of the Pakistani military. Just last week, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mullen was with General Kiani. They talk to them all the time. At the same time, the Pakistani army has lost 1,000 men along the border fighting at the behest of the United States. The United States is paying for the operations of the Pakistani army along the border. As we both know, and people who follow this closely know, under the Obama administration, we have ratcheted up the number of drone attacks along the border. Those drones are based at Pakistani military bases, and the intelligence that the United States uses to kill the Taliban leaders comes, it appears from all reports, from Pakistani military intelligence people on the ground. It is so hard to fathom why we allow the former to continue and still work hand in hand with these people. I think to a degree we are possibly afraid of Pakistan. We're trying to hold on to we don't want the nuclear proliferation, and we don't want anything approaching this horrible, fortunately, amateurish attempt that this man had when he tried to set off a bomb in Times Square, that these militants there will send these people back to the United States. It's a conundrum. I don't understand it. It is tragic for U.S. soldiers.
I think you're absolutely right that there, you know, is the nuclear threat that is at the heart of this, Pakistan being a nuclear nation, and because we just can't be sure of who's really running things and who really has the power there. But the fact that this is allowed to go on, and maybe we can't do anything about it. Maybe this is just a matter of, look, we know it's the devil, but it's the devil we know.
I do think there's an element in that. You know, there's something else at play here, too. What is ultimately America's goal there? Yes, initially it was under the Bush administration. We had to topple the Taliban government. We had to wipe out as much as possible al-Qaeda. It seems to be, although we certainly can't prove it, it seems that the al-Qaeda leadership made its way across from Tora Bora down into the tribal areas of Pakistan. Although I no longer believe, based upon my experiences, that bin Laden is hiding along the border. I don't believe that for a second.
Hold on a second. You don't believe that bin Laden is along that border?
I no longer believe it.
Where do you believe he is?
I don't have the truth, but I'll tell you what my jailers told me and what the Taliban told me, the same people. He's being kept by an institution. What they said was that the Taliban are used for the geopolitical goals of Pakistan. And that would be, among other things, to try and control Afghanistan so as to not allow India to surround it. But they also said al-Qaeda has an internationalist agenda. The Taliban have a local and regional agenda. I firmly believe that. They said, in effect, he's being kept, when they said an institution, they meant Pakistani ISI. How do you prove that? Impossible. But I do know, and I hiked through those areas many times, and 7 hours were hiking along before I was betrayed and captured and taken into that cell. I never saw any village or any cave or any possibility where bin Laden could hide. And if you really look at this deeply, and I studied this when I was in prison and it was traveling through the areas in different times before I was captured, it would be so hard for an outsider to live in these areas where each village is the same clan, you speak the same dialect. How could someone hide? How can someone hide for 9 years in an area where the United States is pinpointing Taliban leaders, where there is really, when we were in prison, we had to stop using a certain amount of water because they said the water is seeping out through the small hole. We were not allowed out in this very, very dark cell, constantly scared to death I was going to be killed at any minute, but we were also allowed to wash. And they said, you have to stop using water. You must pour it on the dirt floor because the water will seep out through this small hole, about as big as a silver dollar, and our neighbors will know that we have more people in here than normal because this water is coming out and it is damaging their house. All the houses are made of baked mud. Mm-hmm. How could anyone hide for longer than, and I was there for 6.5 weeks in prison, how could anyone hide for weeks and weeks and weeks and months without being discovered by someone else in a village? It's not possible. And when you took everything together, I began, and I was doing this for months and months along the border, disguised as a Pashtun, living as closely as I could to them to try and find out, based upon my experiences there as a newspaper reporter in the 80s, based on the context, my understanding of tribal law and tribal culture, why the Taliban so powerful, who is behind them, where is the Al-Qaeda leadership, and why can't the United States find them? I don't have the proof, but I came away with a very clear impression based upon what the Taliban told me and what I observed in my own experiences, that it's impossible for him to hide in a village without being discovered for 9 years along that border.
The Big 550 KTRS, Paul Harris talking with Jerry Van Dyke about his book, Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. And for those of you who may think, oh, this is just a reporter who put on some clothes and snuck across the border for a few weeks and didn't really know anything about the region, that's why he got caught. Let me just tell you, Jerry goes back with Afghanistan to the 70s when he lived in Kabul for a while, and then went back there in the early 80s to cover the Mujahideen, who were the Afghanis who were rebelling against the Soviet Union and their attempt to essentially take over Afghanistan. He wrote a book in 1983 called In Afghanistan and has gone back many, many times, knows that area as well as anybody else, if not better. And when he went there, he was not just some guy trying to get a story, get captured, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And remember that Jerry was only the second American journalist kidnapped in Pakistan. The first was Daniel Pearl. And for Jerry to go back there, considering what happened to Daniel Pearl, took a lot of guts. So he's got some stories to tell here, and I have to break, and we'll come back with more of those in a moment. Paul Harris with Jerry Van Dyke on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Jerry Van Dyke, the reporter who was held as a hostage for 45 days after being taken in February of 2008 by the Taliban. He writes about it in his new book called Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. Jerry, we were talking in the last segment about the WikiLeaks report, which says that the Pakistani intelligence agencies are the ones who are funding the insurgency against us, the Taliban, who we are fighting against in Afghanistan. Are there two different Talibans? As we hear, there are two different Al-Qaedas.
Oh, that is an excellent question, and people really don't understand this fully. I always felt that based upon everything that I was reading and hearing, that we had the Afghan Taliban who were interested in fighting against anybody in Afghanistan, and then the Pakistani Taliban, and they were different. I came away from that experience in that prison cell and in other times as I was traveling along the border before I was kidnapped, that they are essentially the same, and I'll explain why. Where they are different, however, I will say this, is that in Afghanistan, there is no such thing as a fax machine. The men who had me in that cell faxed a ransom note, a demand for a prisoner exchange. They did everything by fax. They with a gun to my head, I had to write a letter, and they faxed that. They got my cell phone number, the home phone number, and then they faxed that letter to my apartment in New York. The FBI, already with other American intelligence agency, or with American intelligence and the military, monitoring everything closely, was very quickly able to pinpoint exactly the call station from which they sent that fax in Pakistan. So to that degree, in one element, the Taliban in Pakistan are able to use technology. In Afghanistan, there's really no such thing as there are cell phones, there are satellite phones. We now have the internet, of course, but there are very, very few internet cafes, if you will, whereas they do exist in Pakistan. However, when I was there, I was forced to, in a very dark cell, we were not allowed out at night, and I was forced to listen for hours to Taliban recruitment cassettes and Taliban suicide recruitment tapes, cassettes. What I realized was, as they played these haunting, these messages over and over, there was a call to fight the invader, the call to, interestingly, Pashtun history, Pashtun geography, Pashtun poetry. Now, the Taliban are Pashtuns, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. They hate, they do not pay attention to, no Afghan legislature has ever approved of or said it would accept the border that separates Afghanistan and Pakistan. To the Pashtuns, the Taliban, it is the same. As I listened to these tapes, it began to become clear to me that while the Pakistanis are clear, and I had a conversation with President Karzai for 2.5 hours one night about this before I was taken, that the Pakistanis are using the Taliban to drive a wedge into Pashtun culture to try and control the Pashtuns. At the same time, the Taliban were in these tapes were talking about Pashtun history. They have their own agenda, and that is a combination of nationalism and religion. And I think that they, what they are concerned about more than anything else is defeating everybody, anybody who is in their land. They want to create a strict Islamic government there. And to me, there's no difference in that regard between a man who's Pashtun who lives in Afghanistan or 30 miles away across a border. It's like no difference from crossing across any state line in the United States in Pakistan. Where there is a very, very distinct difference is that Al-Qaeda is made up of foreigners, none of whom are from that area. They're Arabs, they're Chechens, they're Egyptians. They come from different parts of the Muslim world. Now, one is born in Afghanistan or Pakistan along there, and their agenda is international. So the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban are, to me, one and the same. Al-Qaeda, completely different.
Jerry, why'd you give the Taliban your home phone number?
Because I had a rifle to my head.
What did they do with it, besides sending that ransom message?
As I mentioned in the book, when I came back, when the FBI brought me back, escorted me back to New York, got off the plane, JFK, New York, five or six FBI agents and other plainclothes people I didn't know at the time who they were, as well as New York City policemen, escorted me, and I had a beard and long hair, and I was trying to hold my clothes up because I had lost so much weight. They brought me through customs, and everybody got out of the way, and they brought me through, and they took me into a room just off of customs here in New York. And the man next to me, he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Welcome home, Jerry. You're safe. You're safe." He said that twice. Then across the table, an FBI agent, and the FBI is in charge of all kidnapping cases involving Americans anywhere in the world. I did not know this. They were deeply involved in my case. They're still deeply involved in my case. This FBI agent said to me, "When you go home," which means they had been here, "when you go home to your apartment, you will see that the red light is blinking on your answering machine. There are messages on there from the Taliban. Please tell us if you recognize those voices and what the messages might mean. Don't do this for a few days. We advise you not to do that." I came home. I was afraid. I saw the lights blinking. I was afraid to answer them. I was frightened. I thought I was finally, maybe free of them. I played the messages. I talked to the FBI. I have received about 40 to 50 phone calls since then. Why don't I change my number? Because I'm trying to find out where the calls are coming from. My case is not over. The Taliban, I have a rifle to my head. I had to give that phone number. It was either kill or be killed, or they would kill me otherwise, or the translation was, "We will smash your heads." I had no choice. It came back home to me.
Are you still afraid?
I'm wary. Because they didn't just get my phone number. They got my phone number of my family, too. My brother and I'm not married. My brother and my sister and their, who live out west. And I do not mention their names in the book. I can't.
Right.
What I worry about, what bothers me, is that I had caused members of my family to feel afraid. You become, as a journalist, you feel, okay, I'm going to go to try to find the truth. I want to do this. What you don't think of, it's an element of pride, an element of, and one thing I certainly did learn is humility, is the problems I caused my own family, the fear that you've put them through, the suffering, and then how it comes back that you feel that they feel that you might have put their children in danger is something that is very, very hard to live with. So, yeah, I am wary.
I can completely understand why you'd be wary and why you'd want to keep private any information about anybody that you knew.
That's right.
I'm curious what happened to the people you had been working with over there, not the ones who betrayed you, but the innocent people, maybe a translator or somebody else, who were working with you and helping you as a reporter to get the story.
That's just it. I feel, I cannot prove it, but the Now, the FBI is in charge of, as I mentioned, kidnappings of everybody in the world. This, my case, goes on, and there have been others since mine. They come together in certain ways, and the FBI is trying to do what it can to, as they put it, get these guys, to get these people, to bring this to a halt. I can't prove it, but many have told me, and I've tried to learn so much about this, but I'm so many doors have been closed on this, and the FBI said we brought, because there was a predator overhead for 3 weeks when I was there. To this day, I don't know if that predator was there to try and find me or to kill the Taliban who were coming and going from the compound where I was kept. The FBI would only say, we brought all assets into play. Now, what this means is that the FBI are still trying to find the people who are involved in my case. I cannot prove it, but I feel strongly that I was betrayed by the very people, including my interpreter, who went in with me.
Jerry Van Dyke, who was kidnapped in February of 2008 and held for 45 days by the Taliban, tells his remarkable story in his book, Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. We'll take a break and come back with more. I'm Paul Harris. This is the John Brown Show on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with reporter Jerry Van Dyke, who's written a book about the 45 days he was held by the Taliban in the beginning of 2008. It is called Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. When you pick up the book, you'll notice there are no pictures. You know, a book often has a little part in the middle with the nice glossy photos. None of those when you're being held in a one room inside a prison by the Taliban for 6.5 weeks. But did you get to know these guys at all? I don't mean in a good way, but in any kind of way where you played along with them, and so they felt like you sympathized or at least empathized with them, Jerry?
What you do in a primal sense, you're doing all that you can. I was doing all that I could to stay alive because I was constantly being threatened that I would never get out of there unless I converted to Islam. I went through a mock executions. I was certain that I would be killed, and I used to lie in my cot at night and wonder where I would rather be beheaded or shot. And so what you do is try and get close to somebody to show them that, to try and bring you together so they will perhaps like you a bit without being ingratiating yourself to them, without being trying to become their friends, because they would see through that. There's something very reptilian, very primal about this entire experience, was that I knew and they knew that they could kill me at any second. At the same time, I was trying to win them over without showing that I was a coward, without showing that I was trying to play up to them. So it's a very, very fine line. Also, how do I show them, and this is crucial to survival, how do I show them that I am not a spy, that I was there to find out about them. I was there to learn about, I would tell them, I'm here to learn about you. Who is behind you? What do you stand for? What are your goals? What do you really believe in? To talk like that, to get them to bring this out so they would talk about themselves, but never go so far as that I would be seen as a spy. How can I find out about bin Laden? I would go for days and days and weeks to try and figure out how to pose these questions, to draw them in, to become close to them, and they would have fascinating conversations about the difference between their culture and my culture, or our culture. I learned a tremendous amount about them. When I went there, my goal, as I just mentioned, was to go deep into the heart of the Taliban, to find out about them, and to find out, if I could, to a degree, about Al-Qaeda. When I was in that prison, I thought, all of these years, so many years now, I have worked in this area, I understand this language to a degree, the culture, I have failed. I was so ashamed and humiliated that what had happened to me, and I knew, without knowing exactly, all that would be done for me to save my life. And yes, I was the next foreigner captured in Pakistan after Daniel Pearl. A great number of people were trying to prevent the next Daniel Pearl. So I was doing all that I could to get along with them, but to learn from them to save myself. And in the end, I did find out a great deal about them. They knew that I was writing a book. I pleaded with, and they finally gave me a pen and then a notebook. At first, late at night, I would take the small flashlight that they gave us because the room was too dark. I could never see across the room. And we were only allowed out at night for a few minutes. And I would take notes very, very, when no one was around, hoping that they thought it was just a diary. In the end, they let me take those notes during the day. They knew I was writing a book. They wanted to tell their story. They wanted to tell me about themselves. I just had to make sure that I was never seen as going too far and that I was a spy. One problem was that my interpreter, in the end, became so afraid that he became closer and closer to them, and I felt, and he wouldn't interpret for me, and so I was increasingly alone, and that made it extremely difficult and hard to really, but I honed in like a laser and tried to understand as much as I could. I certainly made a lot of mistakes, but thanks to a great number of people in this country and the Taliban themselves, I'm still alive.
One last question I got to ask you, Jerry, going back to the WikiLeaks story, because you mentioned that these Taliban captors are, in a way, sons of the Mujahideen, who you covered in the early 80s when they were fighting back against the Soviets, because Afghanistan's history is one of invasion after invasion after invasion and trying to repel the invaders. The WikiLeaks story says that the Taliban have been using portable heat-seeking missiles against our aircraft. This had not been publicly disclosed by the military, but this is the same type of weapon that we provided them in what was called Charlie Wilson's War, that we gave the Mujahideen nearly 30 years ago. What's your take on that?
Excellent point. I thought of that same thing today when I saw, or yesterday when I first read that report. I noticed that all the time that I was with the Taliban, they used the very same type of weapons, all Soviet 1980s vintage weapons. I wondered, are these the same weapons that we gave their fathers beforehand? In the 1980s, when the United States was giving, yes, Charlie Wilson's war, billions of dollars in weapons with which to fight the Soviet Union, all of those weapons went through the Pakistani military intelligence agency, the ISI. At that time, Stanfield Turner was head of the ISI. I remember very clearly reading in the newspaper where he said, we expect 20% of this to be siphoned off, meaning by the Pakistani military. Now, were those Stinger missiles that were used against the Soviet Union, the same by the United States gave, the same weapon that shot down that U.S. helicopter in Helmand Province? I don't know. Can that weapon be used after 20 years if it's being kept in the ground, or have they been kept in warehouses along with the other weapons? Because where's all the ammunition has come from that the Taliban are using for the last 9 years?
Or is somebody else providing them weapons just as we did 30 years ago?
They said to me, we are trying to get weapons from Iran. If we can get they didn't use the term heat-seeking, but they said if we can get weapons to shoot down planes and helicopters from Iran, they will come to Pakistan. Pakistan will change the markings on them. No one will know where they came from. I don't know the truth.
Jerry, I could talk to you about this all afternoon, but instead I'm going to tell my listeners to read your story, because you're a great storyteller, and it's a remarkable story, and your decades of insight into it just add to its importance. The book is called Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. Jerry Van Dyke, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed your questions and our conversation.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.